live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network celebrity segment. Again, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And for my Pittsburgh affiliates, you guys got to be really excited to have this guy back on. And I wonder, last time he's talked to the Pittsburgh media before, but I want to welcome the program, Mike LaValliere, Golden Glove winner, Pittsburgh Pirate, and much, much more, a.k.a. Spanky. Mike, thanks for calling, man.
Neil, it's my pleasure to get a chance to speak with everybody.
Well, absolutely, Mike. It's just the memories of the Pirates of that time, and our second segment, we're going to kind of rehash and talk a little bit about how great it's to see the Pirates, the resurgence of the Pirates, and I'm sure that makes you happy as well to see the Pirates after so many years of having down times.
You know, Neil, even though I played with four teams, the Phillies signed me. I played with the Cardinals, then get traded to the Pirates and the White Sox. But whenever I look back at my career, I kind of identify myself as a Pirate, and I've moved here to Bradenton, the spring home of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and ended up coaching with them in spring training, this past year, and working with the catchers. So, I have to look back at it, and even though I was a Cardinal, I was rooting a little bit harder for the Buckos.
Well, that's good. You're definitely getting some brownie points. So let's talk about, Mike, how you got discovered to get into the major leagues. Did you always think you were going to be a major leaguer, first of all? Did you think?
Well, to tell you the truth, back in high school, I was probably a better hockey player than I was a baseball player. I grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, and had an opportunity to go up to play in the Junior A League as a high schooler, and chose not to because I would have had to quit baseball. So, for a time there, it was, really, I was my first love was hockey, and, I really thought that's if I was going to ever make it to, someplace, it was going to be in that sport. I ended up, it worked out for the best, obviously, and I got a couple of breaks and, took advantage whenever I had the chance.
Absolutely, and it's a situation. So you kind of got involved in baseball and stuff like that. When did someone discover you to kind of get that opportunity to be in baseball, or was it someone saying, you got to change sports for sure?
Well, I tell you one thing, Neil. I went to college up in New England also, and at the time, back in the early '80s, late '70s, there wasn't a whole lot of guys coming out of there, to play baseball. And in the draft of 1981, I believe there was 57 rounds, and at the time, 28 teams possibly, and not one of them thought that I was good enough to play. And I ended up signing as a free agent. I was playing in the Cape Cod League. I still wanted to play. And, I was having a fabulous time there. And, I enjoyed school. And, I was just, going to see if possibly somebody, I could change somebody's mind maybe my senior year. And ended up having a good hot streak whenever there was a Philadelphia Philly scout in town scouting us in the Cape League. And he ended up taking a liking to me and watched a couple games. I ended up going, in the two games, 8 for 9 with a homer and a couple of doubles, some RBIs, some good defensive plays at third base, and he signed me right then and there, and that's where it all started.
Wow. It must be amazing to have that opportunity and say, oh my gosh, now I'm signed. Who would have thought I would be playing baseball? And so you're in the minor leagues, and once you're in the minor leagues, did you feel that you were going to get up to the majors quickly?
Well, my first spring training, they had told me that I was going to be, they were going to make me a catcher. And hadn't caught before, but kind of saw the writing on the wall at the time, especially in the early 80s. They got a guy named Mike Schmidt that was playing third base from Philly. And I figured, you know, maybe beating him out wasn't probably the easiest thing to do. So I went right along with it. And, you know, I had a couple of great guys, Rolly DeArmas, who's still with the Phillies organization, and P.J. Carey. These two guys working with me in spring training. They taught me the right way to do things. And it was just, you know, I get some great coaching. I knew I had to push hard to make myself better, but I knew there was no chance I was going to make it to the big leagues as a third baseman, so moving to catcher was the right thing to do, and it all worked out for the best.
And definitely worked out for the best. So when did you know you were finally going up to the majors? What did, getting the call, was that awesome?
Well, it was, I remember, I started off the year, and it was kind of a weird year in 1984. I had, started off the year by getting married. So we'll start with the real weirdness. Just kidding. We'll be celebrating my wife and I our 30th.
Oh, congratulations! That's great.
This upcoming February. But yeah, I went to spring training. Was intent on making it to the Triple A team, and ended up having a trade or two right at the end of the spring, and I got bumped back to Double A. And I remember in the locker room, the minor league coordinator with the Phillies, Jim Ballmer, kind of sat me down and said, "Hey, look, we really like you. We got a spot for you in the coaches' room next year. Just go out and have a good year." So, according to the Phillies, I was pretty much done, and they wanted to make me a coach. Well, I went back to Double A. I was a backup catcher again. Ended up a couple guys get hurt, probably about 8 guys get hurt.
Wow.
Ended up going to Triple A. Their guy, the starter in Double A, they didn't feel he was ready, and I was. So I get up there and had an opportunity to catch every day for a month and a half, and really had a great month and a half. And Lee Elia was the manager in Portland. I was playing out in the Pacific Coast League, and I don't know exact the date, but it was right around October or August 28th, last week of August, and he calls me into his office, and I'm thinking, man, I've been behaving, I'm having a good year. Is he going to chew me out for something? And so he sets me down and says, Spank, you're getting called up in September. And that was obviously pretty amazing. And I ended up getting called up in September, and just for the basic warm up some pitchers and drink some big league coffee.
So when you get to Philadelphia, I have to jump back, because when you brought up Spanky, and I'm sure you were excited that I remembered that and brought that up, because again, it just brings back memories. Who gave you that nickname?
Well, actually, Jim Fregosi, he was my manager in AAA with the Cardinals. And actually, when Lee Elia called me in, my nickname with the Phillies was Bulldog. And so he called me Doggy. And so the next year, I end up getting traded to the Cardinals. And Fregosi looked at me and said, "Spanky." And I said, "Well, what's up?" He goes, "You look just like the Little Rascals character." And I says, "Well, what if I don't like it?" He goes, "Well, yeah, tough luck, kid. That's the one that's going to stick." And that's the one that ended up sticking.
It definitely ended up sticking. So you played with the Phillies for how many years?
I was with them from 81 until 1984. Then went over to the Cardinals for 85 and 86. And then started my career with the Pirates in 87.
And that's what I really want to go to, is the Pirates. You had a feeling I would go there. Those years in the Cardinals. So you were you a platoon player with the Cardinals?
Actually, I started off the year as the backup catcher in 1986. They traded for Mike Heath, and at Heath he was the starter, and you know, things didn't work out for him. And about the middle of June, I was took over, and I was the everyday catcher in St. Louis in 86, and ended up playing 110 games that year as a rookie.
Okay, so when you finally ended up with the Pirates, were you excited about going to this organization? Did you know a lot about the organization and its tradition and everything when you got the call up?
To tell you the truth, Neil, we were in last week a spring training with the Cardinals, and there was a B game early that morning, and there was only two catchers in camp because it's the very end. It was Steve Lake and myself, and Steve had caught nine innings of the morning game, and so I'm getting ready for the afternoon game, the 1 o'clock game, and out in the outfield and doing my jogs and you know, getting loosened up. And Dave Ricketts, the coach of the catching coach with the Cardinals, comes in and says, "You're not playing." And I said, "Well, what's going on? I'm fine." He goes, "You're not playing." That's all he told me. And then he grabbed Van Slyke and he says, "You're not playing, Andy." And so right then and there, it was kind of like, all right, what's up? And then they said, well, yes. And I go, well, who's going to catch? Well, Steve Lake. So here's a guy who's going to have to catch a doubleheader in spring training, which is, you know, a lot of guys don't catch doubleheaders right during the season, never mind spring training. So right then and there, I knew that I was traded. And so Andy and I talked to each other during the game, and we figured, you know what? There's only two places where we really didn't want to go. We didn't want to go to Montreal because of the hassles of going through customs, you know, in and out of the country. And we didn't want to go to Pittsburgh because they had lost 100 games like 4 years in a row. And, you know, things were just really not very good. initially, the trade was, it was someone, someone had killed my dog. You know, St. Louis, absolute fabulous organization, great city. And, you know, here I am going from one of the best situations in baseball to, at the time, one of the worst situations. But it went with an open mind. Jim Leland, the very first day, welcomes us into the locker room. And, he just said he made an instant impression, right there. And I said, well, you know what? Playing for this guy, I don't know what else is going on. I didn't know anybody else on the team other than Andy. But, you know, if everything's like this guy, you know, things are going to be all right.
Well, absolutely, and getting to Pittsburgh and, again, a losing team. It kind of sounds like what we'll talk about for a couple minutes on this show because I'm so interested in the story, Mike. And when you come up with, what are we going to talk about? You see, it's like just you and I having a cup of coffee, learning about you and learning the background. I mean, the backup story, the background going to the Pirates. So once you get there, you're in almost the same boat as a lot of the Pittsburgh Pirates today that were winning. They were a terrible team. They were bottom feeders. I'm sure the crowds weren't very big at that time. But you went to, once you finally got to Pittsburgh, I'm sure you saw the tradition, right? You saw the
fans. We had good group of guys, and you could see that there was talent, but we made mistakes. We made young mistakes, and, that was the one thing is, we held each other accountable, and that's the kind of team we had. We were close really from the get-go, and, it was just kind of like everybody, had that goal of, number one, selfishly, to stay in the big leagues, but number two, let's make something out of this. And, it was just, everything, the kids, the wives, the coaches. It really was a family. And, I think that was a big part of the development of our success there was, everybody cared about each other. And, that's a big part of it, knowing that you're not all out there by yourself. You get somebody that's got your back.
So you turned it around pretty quickly, right? I'm kind of, being a historian, going back and remembering. I remember 91, 92, 89. So you got to the Pirates in what year?
I got there in 87, and, you know, that year, I think we, I think we finished 80 and 82, so we're just slightly under 500. And then 88, we contended for a while, but the Mets were just too good. And 89, we went into that season thinking, all right, this is it. You know, this is time for us to, you know, jump up and play with the big boys. And we had a rash of injuries early in the year, and Sid Bream went down with a knee injury and missed, three or four months. 2 days after he went down, I went down, had a play at the plate, and I missed 3 months. Vance Slyke, within 2 weeks, he hurt his back, and he you know, ended up missing some significant time. So, you know, 89 was kind of a mulligan. Where, you know, a lot of promise to start with, and, you know, just didn't keep the horses on the track. And you know, going into 90, you know, we knew that, you know, we still had the right pieces and we're all healthy, and that's really, you know, when things started to gel.
All right, so when we get back, more of Michael LaValliere, Spanky, and we're going to go into specifically, I guess, your fondest memories in Pittsburgh. Then we're going to go into what your thought of this year's Pirate team was, and next year, and then also life after baseball. You're listening to Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network celebrity segment. Again, you can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, or SimplyG.com. to find out information on G.J. Reynolds, the playful and powerful warrior. And I'm with Mike LaValliere, the great catcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates, a.k.a. Spanky, and we're learning about certain situations. So I could go into a story and we could talk about for hours. It's kind of funny. He said, you want me to prepare? I said, Mike, I will just talk Pittsburgh Pirate baseball with you. So I'm blue in the face, and I'll tell you my feelings, and I really want to air my feelings out on the radio regarding the Pirates and their resurgence. But talking about, what were your fondest memories in Pittsburgh?
Well, actually, you know, there was, I'd have to say, I mean, there's three, you know, that, you know, just, I want to say, games or events that stuck out. And actually two of them, were away, we clinched in 1990, we were actually at Busch Stadium. And that's the first time I had clinched to go on to a postseason play. And I remember that feeling of, you know, the excitement. You know, we had a fabulous year in 90. You know, Bonds ended up the MVP. Dravek was the Cy Young. And you know, it was just, you know, we had finally gotten to where we needed to be. And I remember getting back home, and this is the second thing, you know, it's later on, but being met at the airport, the old airport in Pittsburgh, yes, by thousands of fans, and this is, I don't know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if it was quite that late, but you know, that's the second thing. I mean, it was just, the first thing was the game, the second thing was the fans that night, and that was just, to me, it was just unbelievable. You know, we went through the terminal, the buses, you know, it couldn't move. There were so many people just jumping up and down. It was crazy. It was absolutely insane. And that, you know, that was, you know, really stuck out. And then, you know, probably the last thing was, the night that they closed Three Rivers. Had a big ceremony, and they brought a bunch of us back, and it was great to see you know, a bunch of my old teammates, and you know, it was just that was a special special time.
And the last question is, what makes Pittsburgh fans the greatest fans in the world? What do you think?
Well, you know, I tell you, Neil, if there was a way of getting our winter here in Florida, in Pittsburgh, I'd live there in a heartbeat. And I think what makes Pittsburgh people great is, you know, great fans is what makes them great people. And, you know, it's just, they're, you know what, they're hardworking, they're honest, they love a good day's work, and they appreciate a good day's work. And as a player, you know, you go up there and bust your tail, you obviously want to be successful all the time. Yeah, it doesn't happen. But I think the core people in Pittsburgh, and they've always been there. There was a lot more people that showed up this year. Yeah, but you know what? Those core people have always been there. And you know what? It's down to earth. It's middle America. It's yes. It's the Midwest. It's you know, it's just it's a great you know, place to live, to bring up your kids. You know, to me, it's just fix the winter, and I'm there in a heartbeat.
Well, all right, fantastic. So, Mike, basically, your take on the Pirates, then we'll talk about life after baseball. So, basically, we saw those last couple years of the Pirates, and you know, and I was just this naysayer saying, "Oh my gosh, come on now!" Again, they're going to choke, and then this year it came back again. They came strong out the gates, and everyone thought they'd choke. What were you thinking, you know, watching the Pirates and following them? What made them so special to get to this point? And I think they're going to go farther this year, I'm hoping.
Well, ultimately, Neil, you know, you got to, you know, I reference the horses. You got to have the horses to run the race. If you got a bunch of donkeys, you're not going to win. I don't care how hard they try. I don't care how good the jockey is. But unless you've got some thoroughbreds, you cannot win that race. And coming out of spring training, I think this is the first year in I don't know how long where they actually sent down to AAA some big league caliber guys. And to me, the depth of what I saw position-wise, and especially through the pitching staff. I remember the first day of pitchers throwing to hitters, and I walked around all the cages, and I looked, and I was thinking, if I was a player, and as a catcher, you can kind of pick your cage just to get your hits in. I don't know if I could find a comfortable at bat. And, you know, this is throughout, you know, all these kids that you know, the kids that were coming up from Double-A, the kids from Triple-A, the established big league guys. And I looked around, I said, you know, there's a lot of talent here on the mound. And to me, that's what you have to win. And I'm really, you know, it's easy for me to say, but I wasn't surprised. You know, they had more talent. They were deeper than they had ever been. They've knocked on the door the two previous years, but ultimately, you know, they weren't deep enough. They didn't have enough horsepower. And this year, I thought they did, and they went in and improved it. You know, they've got a great staff. Clint does a great job preparing. He's got some great coaches working for him. You know, but you know, the addition, you know, and to me, the biggest addition was Russell Martin. And I was speaking with Neil Huntington prior to one of the practices. And I says, Neil, you realize with that one acquisition, you made half your team better. And he said, what do you mean? And I says, well, you have 12 guys on your staff. With the addition of a veteran guy like Martin, who can block, he can throw, and he can handle the staff, he's going to make 12 guys better, and then it's an upgrade for what they had catching. That's 13 out of your 25 guys that were better, just with the one acquisition. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, that was, you know, coming out of the spring, I wasn't surprised at all.
Do you think that they're going to be able to repeat this, or do you think with a small market it's so difficult?
Well, you know what? There's a lot of things that have to happen. Obviously, health is the number one concern. They had guys get hurt last year, but they were deep enough and they were able to fill those gaps. You know, with when Grilly went down, Melanson came in and did a fabulous job as the closer. They're going to have to stay healthy. You're not going to be able to miss McCutchen for a great deal of time. You can't miss Pedro Alvarez for a long time. I mean, you're going to have your big guys stay healthy. But you know that's true with every team. You look at what the Angels went through when Pujols went down.
Right.
You know, they're just if your show ponies aren't there, you can't win.
All right, so we'll see if this happens. We'll look at injuries this year if the Pirates don't go where they need to go. Now, Mike, what's going on with you? You were talking about you're involved with ESPN. So you're staying busy after retirement, involved in baseball still in certain aspects. Tell us what's going on with you.
Well, I've been doing some regional broadcasting with Bright House Networks here, doing high school and USF, and doing some college games. Did a couple of Florida State, Florida, and Miami games, and then I get contacted by ESPN3 over in Orlando, and from June until the end of September or early August or early October, I head over to Orlando and I call some youth league games, a lot of all-star competitions, major tournaments, World Series from the different groups of the AAU and other groups that come up to Disney, and anywhere from ages 8 to 18, and had the opportunity to call some fast pitch girls major tournaments too, and it's fun. The kids are exciting. They make some mistakes like all kids do, but the effort is there every single day. It's fun to watch.
Well, that's great to hear. Are you basically anything else? Any other projects you're doing, or pretty much just for ESPN right now?
Well, I'm going to probably help out with our local high school. They just got a new coach, and he's actually a kid that I helped coach when he was younger. And Donnie Robinson, my very good friend, is going to be the pitching coach. So, yeah, we're going to help out. It's Manatee High School, which is pretty much known for their football. But we're going to see if we can help out the baseball program. And also, we'll see what happens. See if Mr. Hurdle and Mr. Huntington can use me again for this spring.
Well, I hope so, and then we'll have to have you back on to give us a prediction and what you were able to experience over there with the Pirates. It's so fantastic. Mike, I tell you, I see bigger things for you. You're such a colorful guy, more than just ESPN3. So I'm going to keep rooting for you to get that next opportunity, because you seem very down to earth. You seem very interested and very knowledgeable. So I'm very impressed by you. And I hope that you get some opportunities to call in the biggie leagues someday too. I think that would be great for you. So we'll see.
Well,
what happens.
Neil, I certainly appreciate the kind words. And my wife is rooting for me to be out of the house a little bit more often too.
So we don't have a website or anything, Mike. We could just wiki you, right? Is that pretty much the best way to find information on you?
That's really, that's about it. I mean, I'm not much for the papers. I do a whole lot of stuff online and getting on stuff on the internet and reading. That's how I do my research. So that's pretty much, I think that's the way of the world now.
Well, Mike, best of luck to you. We'll definitely stay in touch. And if you're in Pittsburgh, we got to have a cup of coffee when you come to Pittsburgh again, for sure.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Neil, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for including me the opportunity to share my story with everyone.
Well, absolutely, Mike. Good talking to you. And you have a great story. Think about writing a book as well. You have some interesting story. You're a great storyteller. Definitely think about that. That'll get you busy too, Mike. So we'll think about that one as well. But thanks again for calling, man.
Okay, thanks again.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, that was Mike LaValliere. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Celebrity Segment. Again, to go to simplyg.com, that's simplyg.com, to find out information on G.J. Reynolds, the playful and powerful warrior, and my website, totaltutor.net. And this is an amazing guest because, again, he's an Emmy Award winner. He is also a New York Times best-selling author. When you talk about sportscasters and career and that name just comes up all the time, so I want to welcome the program, and I'm going to call you a celebrity, Len Berman. Len, thanks for calling and taking the time to come on the Total Tutor Show.
It's my pleasure. I don't know about the celebrity part, but I have been around for quite a while.
Well, absolutely, and then it's an honor to talk to you, especially, and to learn about you and learn about your career, because every one of our guests, the way I do it, and when you go about education, is I interview people to really learn about their story, because that's what my listeners really like to enjoy, is to learn about how did things start for you and everything. Did you always want to be a sportscaster? Was this something you wanted to be in the entertainment field, especially in news?
Absolutely not. I had, as a kid, I had no thought of being a sportscaster. I really didn't know what I wanted to be. I took a series of tests in high school, and they told me I should be an engineer. So when I went to college, I applied to three colleges, Syracuse, Cornell, and Penn, to be an engineer. And I got into Syracuse. I got on the waiting list of one of the others. I forget now which it was. And I wound up going to Syracuse. The first day I was there, I guess I was interested in radio in some capacity, because I showed up at the college radio station the first day and said I wanted to be a disc jockey. And they said, well, everyone wants to do that. And they said they had an opening for someone to read the sports scores on a Saturday night. And for me, that wasn't a problem. I didn't have a date. But aside from that, I really didn't know I could read the sports scores. I know it sounds strange, but at the time when I was growing up in New York, the people who did the sports news on the local television channels were all former New York Giant football players, people like Frank Gifford and Pat Summerall and Kyle Rhodes. I figured, gee, you have to be a former player to do the sports news or some kind of sports expert. Of course, nowadays, as we've all learned, any idiot can go on the air. You don't have to. But at the time, I really thought you had to be some kind of an expert. And that's how it really began, reading the sports scores back in college in the 60s.
Well, it's amazing how we get our start and how we get this love for certain things, especially in the broadcast field. The way I started out, I was a professional wrestler, and then I did a wrestling talk show and a radio talk show, and I thought I'd never be back in the entertainment field. Went back, became a teacher, and then somehow, lo and behold, radio came back to me, and it became a love. But you never know how these opportunities become. So did somebody kind of say, you know, you sound great, especially when you were saying the scores and stuff, and saying this is something that you should maybe consider going further into?
Well, what happened was when I was in high school, I had an English teacher who thought I had a good voice, and he told me that I should become an actor. He was himself an actor. I found out later after he passed away that he was one of the founders of the Roundabout Theater in New York City, and he was my English teacher at Stuyvesant. He thought my voice was a good voice, and he thought I should practice and get it up out of my throat as opposed to from my diaphragm, as he put it. And I never thought of acting, and I never considered acting for a second, because I thought it was impossible to do. But it was the first time I ever thought that I could use my voice for something. And I think perhaps that's why I gravitated towards radio, because of this teacher.
And that's so interesting, yeah. And so you started out in radio. That's very interesting. And so basically, tell us your first opportunity in radio.
Well, at the college station, I became sports director when I was a freshman. It was a fluky thing at Syracuse. They had, I guess there was some party in the newsroom, and they fired all the upperclassmen from the campus radio station. So I was able to become a sports director as a sophomore. And I got to announce Syracuse University basketball games and did sports shows and all kinds of sports activities. The Syracuse basketball games, the first game I ever announced, two people who played in that game for Syracuse, one is the mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing, and the other is Jim Boeheim, who's still the coach at Syracuse. And they played in that first game I announced. And that was fun. I enjoyed it. And I found sports more interesting than news at the time, because it was more immediate. News at the time didn't have all the live shots and live capabilities it has today. Back then, the only thing that was ever live in news were space shots and political conventions. And I just thought sports was more interesting and more immediate, and that's how I gravitated towards sports. I applied for an internship. A broadcast company came to campus, and I applied and won this internship. So I was a news intern one summer in Dayton, Ohio, of all places. And it was a local TV station in Ohio, but the local talk show was the Phil Donahue show. He was just starting out there in Dayton. And they brought me back full-time as a newscaster. a news reporter slash anchor. I couldn't find a sports job out of college, so I took this job back at the station I had interned at in Dayton as a news reporter, and I was there for 3 years.
It's very interesting because, again, Len, the competition that's in Dayton, especially because UD has a great program for communications, so it's interesting. Yeah. You came from Syracuse, went over there, and got a job, and at that time when you were doing this, was this something you just truly loved? Was it like something you said, I want to continue to become better and better in my craft when you were working in Dayton?
Well, I made two decisions at the time, and one I'm surprised at myself. For some reason, I thought everyone was a sports fan, and I learned later in life that that wasn't true. I guess if I realized at the time I might have stayed in news or some other kind of broadcasting, I just thought everyone likes sports, and it's just, you know, so that's kind of a more of a segmented audience.
Yeah.
But I really didn't enjoy the news we were doing in Ohio because at that time it was a lot of fires and car accidents, and I just didn't find it very interesting. So when I was in Dayton, I just kept applying for sports jobs. And lo and behold, I finally, after 3.5 years, got this nibble in Boston, and they brought me back for an audition. And then they brought me in for a second audition. It came down to two guys, myself and this other guy, for a final audition, and they called me and said, the other guy won, I'm sorry. Then they called back and said, you know, the other guy, his wife is pregnant, doesn't want to leave Peoria, so you got the job. And I wound up in Boston as a sportscaster, so that's where the sportscasting really took off from there.
It's the right place, right time type of deal. And again, we're talking to Len Berman, Emmy Award-winning sportscaster, plus also New York Times best-selling author, and just fascinated by, again, just the way this business works. It works like any entertainment field. You go and you gotta pay your dues. You gotta go from one place to the next place. You go from Dayton to Boston. You truly had this passion about sports. And by the way, I had Dave Cowens on my show yesterday, Len, so when you're bringing up the whole Boston thing, so you're a sportscaster in Boston. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I announced Celtics games, and Dave Cowens was playing at the time. I was I was there in the 70s, and Dave was the center. And they won a couple of championships. And I worked with Bob Cousy on the Celtics broadcast. I actually worked on Patriots preseason games and the nightly sportscasts in Boston. It was a great time. This was pre-ESPN, so really people tuned into your station. There were only three stations that people tuned into in Boston for sports or newscasts. And we had powerhouse ratings, and it was a great time. And the sports teams at the time in Boston were tremendous. You had the Celtics winning championships. The Red Sox were in a classic World Series in 75. The Bruins were in the finals a couple of years with Orrin Esposito. And the Patriots in 76 were the best team not to win the Super Bowl that year. And it was a great sports time, and I was there for 5 years. It was tremendous, but I realized at the time it just wasn't the capital of the entertainment business that New York was. Even though I grew up in New York, I just I never considered going back to broadcast there. But after being in Boston for 5 years, you realize all the networks are in New York.
Right.
Yeah, wire services are headquartered in New York. The main news, you know, the only first thing that came along that wasn't headquartered in New York was CNN. Up until then, everything was always everything. All the networks, everything was New York City. So I, you know, I gravitated back to New York, and that's how that happened.
What's amazing when you talk about that is you see that you got to go the pinnacle. If you're looking at New York, L.A., those are the places to be. L.A. for movies and certain things.
Yeah.
And then New York, especially when you're talking news and all the different broadcasts that go there. So was it hard to kind of transition to go from Boston to New York, or your experience in Boston made you a prime candidate for New York?
Well, it was kind of a two-pronged effort. HBO was just starting out at the time. And they actually had a lot of sports. And I
remember completely about that, yeah.
I wound up freelancing for HBO Sports in the late 70s. I had a baseball show on. It was called Race for the Pennant. And one year I co-hosted with Bob Gibson. One year before ESPN was formed, the late Marty Glickman put together a weekly college basketball game of the week that was on HBO. And Tommy Heinsohn and I announced those games. And Larry Bird was in college, and Magic Johnson was in college, and we did a college basketball game of the week. And so I did some of that, and then I landed a weekend sports job at Channel 2 in New York. There was an opening for a 6 o'clock weeknight sportscaster, and I applied, and I came in second again. I lost out to Sal Marciano, who was well known in New York.
Yes.
They stuck me on the weekends. And that was a great break for me because a short time later, they brought over Warner Wolf from ABC to CBS, and Sal was out of a job. But since I was on the weekends, they just kept me there. So I had another lucky break.
It's amazing how you get these breaks and you continue to move on. Would you say for our listeners out there, especially people that want to be in this field, what kind of study did you do to kind of become better and better at your craft? What would you say?
Well, I think you have to work at the craft. I think the study should be ancillary. I think clearly you take English and writing courses and speaking courses and things like that, but I don't necessarily believe that you have to take broadcasting courses. Where you get the most experience is practical experience. So any internship you can get, any on air, and even if you practice in your bedroom, you know, on audio, that's fine too. You just have to get as much practice as you can, and there's a lot of outlets now. I mean, once upon a time, you know, when I was starting out, there were three major stations in each city. Now, with all the cable and the internet, and my goodness, anyone can have a show. I mean, look at us.
Well, absolutely, and if I could tell you that story, but our listeners are more interested in you. It's all about you, and that's why I enjoy interviewing people. But I agree. Every time you kind of look at how can you improve things, it's your research. You have to research. You have to know the news. You have to understand your craft and be able to talk about it. And so you were a huge sports fan growing up. You loved sports. You knew sports was the thing that you need to do. And once you're in the pinnacle of New York City, amazing. And so you're working in New York, but things even pick up more for you, right? From there, right?
Well, yeah, I was doing the weekend sports. I was doing some HBO, and then this new basketball conference comes into being called the Big East Conference. And they asked me to be their first sportscaster, first play-by-play guy when the conference formed in 1979. So we were doing this, excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold.
That's okay.
We were doing this Monday night game of the week, and ESPN was just forming, and it really took off. ESPN took off, the conference took off, and they did that for several years. And then I went over to NBC. They brought me to do the NBC pregame football show when Brian Gumbel left. And I did that for a couple of years, and that then segued into doing the nightly sports news on WNBC, which I did full-time from 1986 until, oh my goodness, I think it was 2009.
Let me kind of jump back for a second, then we're going to take a break, because this is quite interesting for me, is that you had the big deal. You had the NFL. That's where I remember you, Len, and I also remember you, I think, also doing some Big East games and things like that. I mean, because I'm a Pitt fan and different things, and I remember different things in New York, but your name, the way you got your name was the NFL. Wouldn't you agree? That would you say that before the, again, we're talking about all the other stuff you do in NBC?
I think that was instant recognition because there were two big pregame shows at the time. It was NFL Today, and it was the NBC show, which changed the year each year. And you know, Brian Gumbel had done it, and Brent Musburger was on CBS. So whoever it was, what was a domino thing. What happened was Tom Brokaw left the Today Show and did NBC Nightly News, and then Brian Gumbel left NBC Sports to do the Today Show, so they had an opening. And they kind of stuck me in there. It really was a transition time at NBC Sports because the president, the executive producer, they were changing, and so it was kind of a caretaker for a couple of years. But it was great experience, great exposure. Did get my name out there, and it really helped land the local gig at Channel 4 in New York, which was in many ways even bigger than the NFL gig at the time.
Well, and that's what we'll get to. So we get back more about Len Berman's career. And again, it's still spanning in so many ways. And we'll talk more about all that stuff in a way, because he continues to be working. He still does all these different things. But I'm so interested in just learning about Len Berman. So we'll be back more on the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network. You can go to TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and also SimplyG.com. And I'm with Len Berman, Emmy Award-winning sportscaster, plus also New York Times best-selling author, and just learning about your career. And for people listening that don't understand this, you'd say, okay, you went from the NFL to a big gig in New York. What's the difference about working in a media market like New York compared to working anywhere in the United States? Kind of explain that.
Well, you know, the sheer size of it is huge. At one point, I don't know, you know, it was supposedly 10% of the country. It's probably a little less now, but just the enormity of your audience. And when you're on every night, it really gets the juices flowing. What happens when you work a network show, you're on once a week. So something would happen on a Monday. And say, oh, let's go do something. And you couldn't, because by Sunday or the next time you're on the air, it's going to be dated or it's not going to be interesting anymore. So being on every night, and we were a top-rated newscast, and being on with, I mean, you know, I've anchored, co-anchored with people like Al Roker and Matt Lauer and, you know, New York stars like Sue Simmons and Chuck Scarborough. And it's just, you know, there's nothing like it.
Absolutely. And in that process, when you're continue working in New York, you kind of create some niches during that time, right? That really makes you well known with NBC as well. Kind of explain that.
Well, if you can hang in there. I mean, you know, I used to joke that if you stuck Daffy Duck on the air every night, eventually you know, they'll recognize him at the local deli. I mean, you're well known, you're on every night, you become kind of habit forming. And it's great. I mean, and add all to that the success of the New York sports teams over the years. I've worked locally. You know, just about every team except the Nets and Knicks won a championship, and the Jets, of course. But you had lots of championship teams, and that adds the excitement.
Absolutely. And what would you say is your greatest thing I think you're still doing involving in the media still? Is it called Spanning the World? Am I correct?
Spanning the World. Yes. It's a monthly bloopers deal we started locally in New York in 1987. The Today Show picked it up in 1989, and it still lives on the Today Show today. It'll be on December the 27th. We'll sum up the entire year. And once a month, I go on there, and we, you know, play some of the goofy moments in sports. And there's so much out there, and it's a lot easier to come by in this video age than it was, you know, 25 years ago. But it's, yeah, you know, still what I'm well known for. I'm not saying it's the most journalistic thing I've ever done, but it's still, you know, it's fun. People laugh, and the comment you get is you don't have to be a sports fan to enjoy it, which is nice.
So tell me how that developed. How did you come up with the Spanning the World?
It was kind of a goof. We were working the local sports news in at CBS, and this goofy highlight showed up of a harness race in the Midwest. And just as the horse was about to win the harness race, he turns around and bites the horse in second place in the neck. And the track announcer at the state fair in the Midwest announces over the microphone, "Oh, that's the damnedest thing I've ever seen." And it turns out it's something called savaging, but I don't know anything about horses. And my producer and I grew up in New York playing stickball and basketball, so we decided to stick it on the news. But we thought, well, you just can't say the Yankees win and the Mets lose and the nag bit the other one in the neck. So we decided to call it something. And, you know, that's the beauty of local news. You always have to call it something. The funniest thing I love it was when they say new at 11. And like, what, I want old stuff at 11? Of course you want new at 11. I mean, they always have to call it something on the newscast. So we, as a joke, an inside joke, decided to call it Spanning the World. ABC's Wide World of Sports with Jim McKay. One Wide World of Sports would span the globe for the infinite variety of sports. That was our little inside joke. ABC is going to span the globe. We're going to span something else, and we call it Spanning the World. And it was just one highlight, and we would do it from time to time. And then when I went over to NBC, I turned it into a whole monthly recap.
And how did you – you had some great producers to find some funny bloopers, didn't you?
Well, we all – it was a team effort. And, in fact, viewers would – you know, at the time, you didn't have YouTube and 87 million channels. And so it was a little bit of a struggle to find enough stuff every month. Nowadays, there's more stuff than you can shake a stick at. It's just – it's all over the place.
What would you say is your favorite blooper of all time?
Well, it has to be the horse that got bar mitzvahed. I know you're going to wonder what that's all about. Well, this lady had a harness horse at Monticello Raceway in upstate New York, and the horse turned 13. So to honor the occasion, she had a bar mitzvah for her horse, which wasn't really much. They read a few Jewish prayers and had some wine, and that was it. But the kicker to that story was I was showing that footage once, and there was a rabbi in the audience, and I was a little bit skittish because I thought it might be sacrilegious or making fun of the religion to show a horse getting a bar mitzvah. And the rabbi said that, you know, there's nothing in the liturgy that says you can't perform rites for animals, so there's nothing wrong with a horse being bar mitzvah. So I was rather relieved. And then the rabbi said, you know, that really wasn't much of a bar mitzvah. And I know, I'm from Long Island, I knew that. And then the rabbi said, but it must have been one hell of a bris.
That's a great one. And so, and basically right now, every time, for our listeners out there that want to tune into Spanning the World, you visit monthly, you said?
Yeah, it's normally, it's towards the end of the month. It's normally a Thursday, but last week it was a Wednesday, and it's going to be a Friday, December 27th. But it's normally the last Thursday of the month, and it's usually in the 9 o'clock hour, and we go spanning the world for offbeat sports highlights.
Well, I'm going to have to start tuning into that, and then I'll have to tweet you out and say I'm watching that line, okay. And saying that's so cool.
I also I listed on my website the appearances. I have a website called thatsports.com, and I send out a daily free email to whoever wants it, and I always list on the website when Spanning the World is going to be on the air.
So what other projects do you have going on currently, Len?
Well, I have the website, thatsports.com, and that's just a, there's no advertising or anything. It's just a freebie for people who are interested in the sports world. I've written several books, many of them for young readers. One of them made the New York Times bestseller list, Greatest Moments in Sports. I also wrote the 25 Greatest Baseball Players of All Time. The most recent book was Greatest Moments in Sports, Upsets and Underdogs. And what's great is the publisher puts in free audio CDs in the books so you can hear some of the play-by-play moments. So between the books and the website and the Today Show, and I have some other radio and TV things in the wings, so I'm not fully retired yet. I still hopefully have a few years left.
Well, it definitely seems like you do, and it's fantastic. And I'll have to kind of reach out to you in a couple months to have you back on for my author's show to talk about your books, because they're definitely fascinating as well. Especially, I could talk sports for hours on end. So, any current takes you have right now for our listeners out there involving sports? That's a surprise, one of the big news items. Because I'm sure every time you're picked up in a news wire, or someone says we want to talk to Len Berman about certain things. Is there anything you kind of want to talk about that you would say right now in sports that's interesting you? That's interest to you?
Well, today's headline is the Yankees spending $153 million for an outfielder. And it becomes the same old Yankees. They have no farm system. They have no way to develop their own players. So what they do is they buy other players. You know, they've done it since the days of Babe Ruth. And you would think if they took all this money and plowed it into a farm system, which is so bereft of talent, they'd have a better long-range plan. But that's not the Yankee way. They send the nuclear bomb on the payroll, and if they'll do it, that's how they succeed. So there they go again. And but you know, in their defense, they've got a TV network which they own, and they have expensive seats at the ballpark to fill, and it's the entertainment business, and that's how they view it.
So why under Steinbrenner were they able to really do it more often and win with the money, especially when the competition in baseball was basically small market versus big market teams and stuff, and then working.
He had his droughts too. Ironically, the most success George ever found was when he was banned from baseball for a few years, and and the people who worked in his place developed some players out of the farm system. They named Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera and Jorge Posada and Bernie Williams.
That's interesting. Really? Oh, so.
That's the only time they ever really had a farm system when George was out of the picture. So it shows that it can be done if you have some smarts in the front office. But in the Yankee way of doing things, it's not smarts, it's dollars.
I'm just amazed by you just telling me that, because, again, I would have not known that being a Pittsburgh guy. And us developing our farm system is a good thing for the Pirates to continue.
Oh, absolutely. Look what the Pirates have done. I think it's a remarkable story. I used to say that there's no way in hell the Pirates or the Reds will ever be competitive again. And look what they've both done with smart front offices, spending wisely. And I root for those teams. I really do. There's nothing more beautiful than sitting in the Pittsburgh ballpark in the summertime on the river, and I'm so glad the Pirates are back and that their player won the MVP and that they're a factor again, because Pittsburgh's got a great baseball history. The same with Cincinnati. So the whole idea that a small market team can't succeed is a fallacy. Now, they're not going to succeed if they don't try. So clearly the teams that have the resources, like the Red Sox and the Yankees, are going to have a shot. And St. Louis has some pretty good resources, and they're in it quite often. And money gives you a chance to be in the game. But you can be really smart. And, Oakland's proven it for years. So I root for those small markets.
So, Len, is baseball your favorite sport? Is your favorite sport?
Well, I grew up on baseball. I was a Mickey Mantle fan. So I think baseball was always in my heart. You know, when I was growing up, my team was in the World Series every single year. So how could you not be a baseball fan?
So you're a huge Yankee fan then?
No, I was as a kid. What happens is you learn pretty fast. When you work in Ohio and have to cover the Cincinnati Reds, and when you're the voice of the Celtics in Boston and cover the Red Sox, you don't root for anything. You know, you root for people. So, you know, for me, Don Mattingly can never do any wrong, and John Havlicek can never do anything wrong, and Johnny Bench and people I've covered, you know, and Dave Cowens, these are my heroes. But it's not that I'm rooting for them. It's just that I know them as people, and I want them to do well.
That's what happens to me in radio when I interview athletes. I root for them and not the team as much anymore. And it happens in so many ways. Well, Len, it's been just a pleasure taking the time, and I'm definitely going to have you back on to talk about your book in a couple months. But where can our listeners, I guess, learn more about you, sign up for your email, and also purchase your books and learn more about you?
Everything's at thatsports.com, or just Google my name and you'll find me.
And I see you're on Twitter too, so you're keeping up with all that stuff. That's good.
I'm there at Len Berman Sports. Yep.
And I'm sure people tweet you questions about sports because you seem like you're just a sports aficionado in so many ways.
They tweet me there, and also on my website, they're always, I'm answering hundreds of emails a day. So if you're going to write to me, just keep one sentence, okay? Because anything more, it goes delete. I don't have time to read people's life stories. But if you ask me a quick question, I'm happy to answer.
And any new books coming out? You think you're going to write something else?
Well, we're thinking about it. The publisher wants me to write another book based on Spanning the World. I'm not sure I'm going to do it yet. It takes a lot of time and effort. And what's really hard, as you know, is the promotional aspects of books. So I don't mind writing them. It's the promotion that's hard. So I'm thinking about it.
Well, I'm going to send you the one-sentence question, especially when I'm thinking a sports team's going to do really well. What's your take? Because you really have that knowledge. And it was an honor to have you on the show. And thanks again for calling, Len.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Simply G Media Network, and we'll be back in just a moment.